This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
right. Can't get enough of that rockin' Garifuna music. Opening up with some sounds of Honduras tonight on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM. Here in New York City, where my name is Bill Weinberg. Now, the uninitiated amongst you probably thought that that music was from West Africa, but it's actually from the East Indies. I'm sorry, it's from the West Indies. It's from the Caribbean coast of Honduras. This is actually one of the classics of the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. We've been playing this cut for years, intermittently, when the occasion demands it, because it's really one of my favorites. I just love the hell out of it. In fact, it was even on one of our special compilations that we made for premiums in the past, so maybe some of you who are listening at home tonight actually know that cut. And if there's any Garifuna who are listening tonight, and there is a substantial Garifuna community in New York City, particularly in the Bronx, we'd love to hear from you and find out what they were singing about. The they in question was the Tribu Garifuna from their album Tribu Garifuna Numero Dos, recorded in Tegucigalpa, Honduras in 1995. And, well, you know, we know that Honduras is in the news. The Garifuna were briefly in the news, which is good. There was a story in the Miami Herald which mentioned over the weekend there was this big mobilization at the Honduran border, of course, where the ousted president, Manuel Zelaya, symbolically stepped back into Honduran territory for around 30 minutes and was greeted by some 400 of his protesters who had braved police barricades and made their way past, phalanxes of police throwing tear gas and spread out into the bush to evade them and made their way to the border to greet the ousted president. There were some, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 others around a couple of kilometers away who didn't make it past the police barricades. But there was a big scene there at the border. It unfortunately came to light afterwards that one protester was killed, a young bricklayer from Tegucigalpa by the name of Pedro Magdiel Munoz Salvador. His body was found the next day. The protest was, and Zelaya's attempted return to from Nicaragua to Honduras was July 24th. Pedro Magdiel Munoz's body was found the next day nearby with signs of prolonged torture, apparently. This is according to Honduran human rights groups, has not been reported in the mainstream media in this country. Of course, if you want to follow this stuff, go to WorldWar4Report.com. Been doing daily updates in collaboration with Weekly News Update on the Americas, who have also been doing frequent updates, which we post to our website as well. So unfortunately, it did not get reported that this guy was killed, and he was not the first. There have been several now. It's also the last time that Manuel Zelaya attempted to return. A couple of weeks ago, when he tried to fly into the Tegucigalpa airport and was not able to do so because the military placed vehicles on the runway. Similarly, there was a huge mobilization by his supporters at the airport, and two people were killed by the security forces. So, but it is interesting that the Garifuna were mentioned in the Miami Herald of July 22nd. Noted that in all of the protests which have been held demanding the reinstatement of Manuel Zelaya, there has always been a very prominent presence by Garifuna contingents from the Caribbean coastal zone of the country, engaging in their traditional drumming, chanting, singing, and dancing at the protests. So it probably sounded very much like what we just heard in the opening music from El Tribu Garifuna. And there was a quote. I'm so glad that the Garifuna got a little bit of coverage in the Miami Herald. There was a quote from Saleo Alvarez Casildo, who is the president of the Organization for the Development of Ethnic Communities of the Honduran Coast, ODECO. A Garifuna himself, although I imagine that there are Miskito Indians and other Afro-Hondurans, which are represented by his group, the Organization for the Development of Ethnic Communities. He said, "We have been in a continuous struggle for decades to have a voice, to be visible, to have representation. It's not that we supported Zelaya, but we have our own very good reasons for wanting a constitutional assembly." All right, now this is very key, because the mainstream media reportage has overwhelmingly portrayed it as Manuel Zelaya was just on this sort of power grab, and that the only issue in the supposed, in the constitutional reform, which was the supposed justification for the coup d'etat, the only issue was that he wanted to get term limits removed and set himself up for president for life. Just like Hugo Chavez has now, through a popular vote, by the way, through means more democratic than Michael Bloomberg did it here in New York City, has succeeded in getting term limits overturned in Venezuela. So this is how the media has been portraying it. But in reality, if you do the math, it doesn't quite work, right? Because on the very day that he was overthrown, which was June 28th, there was to have been a non-binding vote, which would establish a popular mandate for opening a constitutional convention. Then the binding vote, which would actually establish the constitutional convention if it passed, was to take place simultaneous with the new presidential elections in November. So, at best, Zelaya would have been able to, if term limits were in fact overturned in the constitutional reform, at best he would have been able to come back in 4 years and run again, right? He could not have, immediately run again and have two terms back to back. I mean, the math just doesn't work. So, this is one thing which the media has just been getting maddeningly wrong. The media have been getting maddeningly wrong. And really kind of just playing along with the propaganda of the de facto regime, which now rules Honduras. So, okay, so if the big issue behind the proposed constitutional reform was not getting term limits overturned, what was it? Well, the big issues which Zelaya talked about were beefing up the labor code, which would definitely be a good idea in Honduras, and extending national control over the power sector, the electrical sector, and the telecoms, and actually, getting text in the Constitution which mandates that they have to be publicly owned. The electrical plants have largely been privatized over the course of the past several years, and the telecom system has been moved towards privatization, about which perhaps we'll have more to say later. Those are the issues which he pushed. He did not talk about getting term limits overturned. He talked about beefing up the labor code and mandating national control over key sectors of the Honduran economy. Those are the issues he was talking about. And significantly, the indigenous peoples of Honduras, including the Garifuna, they want a constitutional reform so that they can get autonomy for their zones of control. They can get their own regional self-government on their own lands, such as is in the constitution of Venezuela, such as is in the Constitution of Colombia, although it is not honored in Colombia in the state of warfare, where none of the armed actors in the conflict are respecting the constitutional right of the indigenous peoples of Colombia to have territorial control of their own communities. But nonetheless, it after a hard-won struggle, it was in the 1991, I believe, constitutional reform in Colombia. So there is precedent for this kind of thing in Latin America, as it is in the constitution of neighboring Nicaragua, neighboring to Honduras, again after a long struggle, and as is demanded by these Zapatistas and indigenous movements in Mexico, although has not been instated there yet. So this is why the Garifuna have been showing up, and so have the Chibchan and Maya related peoples of Honduras, who are in the central mountains, have been showing up at the protests to demand the reinstatement of Manuel Zelaya, as have the Garifuna, who are from the Caribbean coast. And, you know, I think that this quote is very interesting. It says, not that we supported Zelaya, says Celeo Alvarez Casildo, Garifuna leader. It's not that we supported Zelaya, but we have our own very good reasons for wanting a constitutional assembly. Now, it should be said that, you know, Manuel Zelaya and his arch nemesis, Roberto Michelete, the de facto president of an illegally installed president of Honduras now, are from the same party. Okay, let's keep that in mind. They're both from the same party, the Liberal Party, which is one of the two big parties which have traditionally, you know, been controlled by the oligarchy and have run Honduras for the past, century and more. There's the Liberal Party and the National Party, and they're both, you know, very, very elitist and embedded in the, the sort of traditional political culture of the Ladino oligarchy in Honduras. And traditionally, the peasants and the indigenous peoples have been excluded from participation, from meaningful participation in the political process in Honduras. Well, since he got elected a couple of years ago, Zelaya he did not run on a particularly populist platform, but he sort of moved to the left since he was elected. Now, it should be said that getting presidential term limits overturned was not one of the issues which he talked about in his constitutional reform, neither was autonomy for indigenous peoples one of the issues that he talked about in the constitutional reform. But if there was going to be a constitutional convention, certainly the indigenous peoples would organize to put it on the table, and for this reason they've all been demanding the return of Zelaya to power. And I should also mention, of course, in other countries in Latin America which have got such constitutional measures, I forgot to mention the most recent and important example, which is Bolivia, of course, where the new constitution drawn up by Evo Morales and his Movimiento al Socialismo, Movement Towards Socialism, was just instated earlier this year. Similarly, instating local self-government for indigenous peoples and by indigenous peoples and of indigenous peoples according to their own traditions and in their own languages, and recognizing very, very critically their own systems of land use and land tenure, which are neither, you know, the two traditional models of, you know, private property, fee simple private property, so to speak, or, you know, public property, which really means state property, right? It's not either of those things. It's community property, which is actually inalienable, can't be bought or sold, and accrues ad infinitum to, you know, a particular community which has occupancy of the land and traditionally has used the land. So that's the model. Now, what hasn't been getting, so I'm glad that this got a little bit of play in the Miami Herald. That's very good. What hasn't been getting any play in the Miami Herald is that over the past several years up on the Caribbean zone of Honduras, Garifuna leaders have been threatened and assassinated repeatedly by the hired gunmen of the big landlords who are seeking to encroach upon their traditional territories. Primarily for tourism development. You know, there's something which is especially sick about it when it's tourism development. I mean, you know, when indigenous peoples are being pushed from their lands and human rights abuses are being committed in the interests of, you know, the cattle oligarchy or, you know, the banana plantations, you know, at least it seems kind of honest, right? But when it's for tourism development, there's just a special ick factor there, you know? All these gringos are going to be going down there to, like, sit in the sun and drink daiquiris or go boogie boarding or windsurfing or whatever, and thinking that they're in some tourist paradise. And, you know, meanwhile, some family has been evicted from its ancestral lands and its traditional leaders have been assassinated so that, you know, we can have a cheap holiday in someone else's misery, as Johnny Rotten put it. So, like I say, a special ick factor, and that has not been getting coverage in the Miami Herald. Okay, that's been getting coverage in the local papers in Honduras to a certain extent, and a few English language publications up here in Gringolandia, which follow the Central American media, such as Weekly News Update on the Americas and World War IV Report. So, if you want to learn more about it, you know where to go. So, who are the Garifuna, by the way? That's a good question, isn't it? Well, some of you already know, so I'm just going to briefly recap for those of you who don't know. The Garifuna are, they've got a very, very, very interesting history. They are an Afro-Amerindian people. They were originally called the Black Caribs when they were on St. Vincent in the Caribbean a few hundred years ago. And they are basically the descendants of Maroons, escaped African slaves, who fled Jamaica and other islands which were controlled by the British and joined the Carib Indians, from whom the Caribbean is named, of course, primarily on the island of St. Vincent, and adopted the language of the Carib Indians and became known as the Black Caribs. And they were armed by Britain's imperial rivals, the French primarily, and they kept the British at bay for centuries. And then in sometime, I believe, in the 18th century, for generations, I should say. At least for generations, they kept the British at bay. And then sometime, I believe, in the 18th century, there was a terrible war, and they fought each other to a stalemate. The Black Caribs and the Brits fought each other to a stalemate, and they sat down at the table, and they made a deal. And they said, okay, tell you what. You can have land elsewhere if you give us St. Vincent's. And they agreed. And the elsewhere was the island of Roatan, which is off the coast of Honduras, which Britain claimed. And so did Spain, by the way. And in fact, this was sort of Britain's strategy to, establish some facts on the ground. Some people who were not loyal to, even if they weren't loyal to Britain, at least were not loyal to the Spanish crown. And were under, you know, a certain amount of de facto British protection pursuant to this peace deal, get them onto the Caribbean coast of Central America, which was claimed by Spain, of course, although very, very sparsely inhabited at that point. And Spain had very little presence there. There were other indigenous peoples there, primarily the Miskito. So the Garifuna, or the Black Caribs, as they were known at the time, were deported to Roatan. And from there, there's still a lot of them on Roatan, but as they as their numbers grew, they started moving to the mainland. And most of them are in Honduras now, but their communities stretch from Belize all the way down to Nicaragua, all along that stretch of Central America's Caribbean coast. So earlier this year, actually a couple of years ago, UNESCO, the United Nations Social and Cultural Organization, declared the language, dance, and music of the Garifuna to be one of the, quote, masterpieces of the oral and intangible heritage of humanity. Nice phrase there. And that's really good. It's good the Garifuna are getting some recognition because, you know, it's very interesting that, by the way, the rest of the Caribs did not survive. They were all exterminated, right? So the only Caribs who survived were the Black Caribs. So it's very interesting that a indigenous language of the Americas, of the Caribbean, survives only among a people who are primarily of African ancestry and who have very much mingled the culture of the now extinct Carib Indians with obviously with musical and spiritual and probably linguistic elements of the culture of West Africa. So once again, if there's any Garifunas who are listening tonight, a big shout out to you. Maybe you can give us a call later at 212. What is the number? 209-2900. If we decide to take phone calls, maybe we'll take phone calls. Maybe. If people have anything to say. Because I'd sure love to know what El Tribu Garifuna were singing about in that great number that we opened with. All right, I'm going to have more to say about the coup d'etat in Honduras. But before I do, let's hear a little bit more from El Tribu Garifuna. And that song that we opened with was very, very deep and traditional. And usually before I play that song, I give a word of advice, which is if you got them, smoke them. Because, you know, that's real trance music for me. I mean, even if you don't toke, you go into a trance listening to that. But if you toke a little bit first, it's like straight to the stratosphere. So, but this next one I'm going to play is on more of a traditional Caribbean dance music kind of feel. It's got a little bit of soca going on. But the underlying rhythm is exactly the same as the one that we opened with. And this one is about one of my favorite subjects, food. And the very, very closely related question of land. So speaks to a lot of what we're talking about, a lot of the issues of what we're talking about. So, and it's in English, so you don't have to ask me to translate, which I can't do because, shame on me, I don't speak Garifuna. So let's hear a little bit more from El Tribu Garifuna, and we'll be back at you to talk a little bit more about the situation in Honduras. I should say that it is 12:35 in the morning on listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. My name is Bill Weinberg, and here is El Tribu Garifuna. Whoops. Nope. Ah. Faked out by technology. Here we go. Same beat, right? Same beat?
Aye.
Up some of that Ital food. All right. The Tribu Garifuna, going back to 1995. Wow, what a great song that is. Don't sell your land for nothing, even if you're hungry and starving. Plant your land and reap your corn. Eat up some of that Ital food. Yeah, you are talking right on, right on, right on to the Garifuna. And, you know, I mean, this really sort of speaks to the issues which are behind, all this mishigas in Honduras. And, you know, I mean, the media coverage has not been, uniformly bad. You know, I mean, they are, I mean, sometimes it irks me. They refer to Michelete as the, interim president. No, he's not the interim president. He's the de facto president. And frequently they do say de facto president. No nation on earth has recognized the de facto government in Honduras, which is good. And of course, you know, certainly the supporters, and it seems like, you know, most of the middle class in Honduras seems to be behind, the de facto government. You know, they're complaining about how, you know, the media stacked the deck against them, right? So, meaning the world media, the international media, and that, you know, they aren't respecting Honduran sovereignty, et cetera, et cetera. But my real criticism of the media coverage is that it's become too, well, for starters, you know, there's been this obfuscation as to what the constitutional reform was really about. That's my first criticism. There's been a real lack of clarity about that in the English language media. But a related, second and related point is that there's it's sort of gotten tied down in the question of legalisms. And, you know, this has been a real strategy of the de facto government, is to mire the whole question in legalistic sophistries. And, well, you know, I mean, neither side has been completely scrupulous about respecting the Honduran Constitution, if truth be told. And we can talk about the whys and wherefores of that later, if we wanted to, but it's the de facto regime which completely abrogated the democratic process by rousting the president out of bed in a pre-dawn raid by the military and putting him on a flight out of the country in his pajamas. So, you know, anything that they do after that is, you know, illegitimate right then and there. You know, I mean, if there were legitimate reasons, and we can talk about whether or not there were, but if there were legitimate reasons to put to impeach Manuel Zelaya and to put him on trial, then, you know, impeach him and put him on trial and let him answer the charges in court. You know, don't, you know, summarily oust him. So what's at issue ostensibly is that the Honduran Constitution actually states that any president who even proposes amending it is to be immediately relieved of his duties. Now, there's a few things wrong with this. For starters, immediately relieved of his duties presumably does not mean, you know, rousted from his bed in a pre-dawn raid by soldiers and put on a flight out of the country in his pajamas. Okay. The Constitution is vague on that point, but it certainly doesn't make clear that it allows that. So it would seem to be a broad reading of the Constitution, to say the very least. The other point, which is not really being made, is that this Constitution was drawn up in 1982 when Honduras was a military-dominated state. It wasn't quite a military dictatorship, but it just, like around a year before the Constitution was drawn up, it had emerged from being a complete military dictatorship. But the military was still hugely powerful in Honduras. And in fact, the Constitution was drawn up under the close direction of the military. And this was kind of this deal, this sort of three-way deal, which had been worked out at the time between the military, which ceded power, you know, back to the traditional parties of the oligarchy, second party to the deal, the oligarchy, and third party to the deal, the Pentagon, which then was establishing a huge military presence in Honduras as a staging ground for the destabilization of neighboring Nicaragua, which was then under the left-wing Sandinista regime. So two measures in the Constitution which are problematic. The first one saying that there can't be any re-election. You know, once you've been president, that's it. You don't get another chance. Well, that was designed. I've got a soft spot for term limits myself, right? But, you know, it's very interesting that, you know, progressives here in New York support them, but they don't support them in Venezuela, right? Because, you know, there it's Hugo Chavez who's, you know, trying to do away with term limits and extend his term, whereas here it's Michael Bloomberg. But, you know, you can argue about term limits, but, you know, it does depend on political context to a certain extent. I mean, the whole notion of, you know, rotating representatives as opposed to permanent leaders, you know, there's something to be said for that. But the reason that it was imposed in Honduras has nothing to do with that, okay? The reason it was imposed in Honduras under the 1982 Constitution was to keep civilian elected leaders subservient to the generals, subservient to the military, who were really running the show in Honduras at that time, okay? That's the first part on which this is problematic. The second part on which the Constitution is problematic is that, I mean, it's rather absurd that the Constitution actually states that you can't even propose changing it. All right? I can see, you know, you can't change it, okay? There's no process for changing the Constitution under this Constitution. Okay? I suppose that might make a certain amount of sense, although not very much. But, you know, to say that you can't even propose changing the Constitution, that's got, like, real, that's pretty draconian, isn't it? I mean, that's got like real free speech issues, right? So it seems to me that any constitution which has got that provision, it almost mandates being changed, right? It's like screaming to be changed. A constitution which says you can't even talk about changing it? That sort of, to me, that means that constitution needs to be changed. So, all right, so, but once again, all right, bringing it back to the song we just heard and bringing it back to the Garifuna and bringing it back to what we were talking about, you know, these are the issues which are behind all of these legalistic sophistries. I kind of got onto a side rant about the sophistries and the legalistic hair splitting about who violated the Constitution, which I didn't really want to do because I'm trying to, like, keep our eye on the ball and not talk about and talk about the things which the media are not looking at, which is the situation of indigenous peoples and campesinos who are the overwhelming majority in Honduras, who are trying to keep hold of their lands and keep food on the plate and be self-sufficient and not be a captive labor force for the maquiladoras, and to keep their culture alive and their language alive. And in a political system which has, you know, traditionally been dominated by these Ladino oligarchies, and I'm saying Ladino, not Latino. It's a distinction which I hope some of you are getting. You know, I mean, in Central America, Ladino, as in Mexico, means the traditional Spanish-speaking dominant culture, as distinct from the indígenas. Those whose primary language, at least, is Maya or Chibchan or Garifuna or Miskito. All right, so under the traditional political culture of Honduras, the largely white Ladino oligarchy has completely dominated the political process, and the indigenous peoples have just been removed from their lands at will. All right, there was a certain amount of progress with agrarian reforms in the past under very, very, very strict limits by the military. Some lands got titled. But even when lands have been titled, you know, there's still been an awful lot of, it's either force or fraud, you know, one or the other. When one doesn't work, they use the other to remove indigenous peoples, even from their titled lands, if they want those lands bad enough. For cattle ranching in the Central Highlands and coffee plantations, also in areas of the Central Highlands, and bananas traditionally on the Caribbean coast, and more big tourism developments on the Caribbean coast. All right, when they want that land bad enough, you know, whether it's titled or not, they'll use force or fraud to get it. And a constitutional reform had the potentiality, at least, of changing that by opening up the political process to a new form of government, as opposed to the traditional, you know, party system, which has been dominated by the oligarchy. Opening up a new form of constitutionally recognized self-government based on the traditional cultures of the indigenous peoples, and ensuring their land rights and actual, territorial control, jurisdictional territorial control of their lands. That's what is really at issue, and that is why, you know, the peasants in particular are putting their lives on the line to demand the return of Manuel Zelaya to power. Not, I would imagine, because a lot of them, you know, really have a lot of faith in Manuel Zelaya, the man. But because of these underlying issues. And like I say, you know, it's a fighting chance. Even if they got that constitutional reform, and I hope they get that constitutional reform, well, you know, it's worked out better in some places than others, right? I mean, in neighboring Nicaragua, they also, you know, following the whole struggle in the 1980s, there was also a similar constitutional provision, which gives the, particularly the Miskito Indians on the Caribbean coast, constitutional autonomy. And, you know, it hasn't worked out all that well. And it's worked out even worse you know, for reasons which we can discuss. And it's worked out even worse in Colombia, obviously, because Colombia is just a war zone and nobody respects the law in Colombia. So, certainly none of the armed actors in the conflict respect the law in Colombia, as is well established. So, you know, I mean, it's worked out, you know, it's not a magic bullet, the constitutional reform, and it's worked out better in some places than others, but at least it's a start, right? At least it's going to give the Garifuna and other indigenous peoples of Honduras a fighting chance to hang on to their lands and their culture and keep food on the plate. So, this is why I'm supporting Manuel Zelaya's return to power, despite, you know, not being too crazy about the Liberal Party of Honduras, to which, tellingly, both he and his arch-nemesis, Roberto Michelete, belong. But precisely because, well, it looked like, you know, Zelaya was moving in the right direction, and he was, and since the coup, he's been, you know, even if purely for tactical reasons, he's been certainly moving, at least as far as his rhetoric, in a much more populist direction. And perhaps, you know, in spite, even if in spite of him, a constitutional reform could make for some interesting political developments and get things moving in the right direction in Honduras. Well, I wonder what we should do for the last half hour. I want a little bit more music that I'd like to play. If there's anybody who can tell us what El Tribu Garifuna was singing about in the first cut that we opened, anybody out there understands the Garifuna language, maybe you can give us a call at 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. There are also some other things which I'd like to say. Let's see. There is a certain amount of evidence. Certainly, the popular movements in Honduras are claiming that Otto Reich instrumented the coup d'état. And there is a certain amount of evidence to suggest this. The former a veteran of Contragate, and apparently he was assistant secretary, not apparently, he was assistant secretary of state for Latin America during the attempted coup d'état in Venezuela in April of 2002, and was apparently involved in it. Apparently, he was sort of like the Bush administration point man for under-the-table greasing of the attempted coup d'état in Venezuela in 2002. And very interestingly, he has been one thing which has been established. All right, another one of these, another one of the popular organizations in Honduras has been issuing communiques, charging that he is behind it, that Otto Reich was behind it, particularly the Honduran Black Fraternal Organization, OFRANE, which includes many Garifuna, by the way, has been making these public charges. He had a, Otto Reich had a piece in the Miami Herald denying everything, a piece entitled, "I Did Not Orchestrate Coup in Honduras." So they did at least shame him into denying it, in which he denies being the quote-unquote architect of the coup and also denies that it was a coup and says that it was a legal and constitutional removal of the president. So he denies that he was involved, but he's also one of the foremost public advocates of Roberto Michelete and the de facto regime. Very interesting. Also very interesting is that if you go to the website of Otto Reich Associates, you will find that, you know, that's his consultancy firm. You'll find that among his former clients are AT&T and our own dear old Bell Atlantic, formerly 9X, formerly New York Telephone, now Verizon, which we all know and love here in New York City, of course. They were among his former clients at Otto Reich Associates. There was a, over the course of the past several months, this is like the real big scandal of the Zelaya administration in Honduras. There had been all this talk about kickbacks on the part of digital telephone access providers to the state telephone company in Honduras, Hondutel, which Zelaya was, you know, it all happened on his watch while he was president, and it's a state enterprise. So Otto Reich has been a real sort of a pit bull on this issue, and he's been all over the media, about the Hondutel scandal and accusing the Zelaya administration of corruption. And isn't this interesting, right? Now, I don't, maybe there, probably there was corruption. Probably there really were kickbacks where, you know, these digital telephone providers wanted to get in on the action and, in Hondutel and were, and made some payoffs to people. Seems like that probably did happen. So, but isn't it interesting that, that Otto Reich served as a consultant for AT&T and Bell Atlantic, two firms which would stand to, gain if Hondutel was privatized. And one of the, despite the fact that the media is not playing it up and all they're talking about is getting the term limits overturned, one of Zelaya's big issues, which he really promoted in terms of the constitutional reform, was keeping Hondutel, the state telephone company, in public hands. Isn't that interesting? So there's that angle. Then let's see. There was also let's see. Can I find this clip that I'm looking for? Come on, where is it? Oh yeah, here we go. All right. There was also a very interesting piece by our good buddy Nicholas Kozloff, who check out his blog, Señor Chichero. He's been following this stuff very, very closely, been doing a lot of really good investigative legwork. The piece which he ran on this angle was in Counterpunch, which is a publication we don't like very much, but for various reasons. But, you know, we understand the paucity of places to get published these days, which are interested in running really good cutting-edge investigative journalism. But what he dug up, interestingly enough, is that people who were following Honduras back in the 1980s, following Central America back in the 1980s, remember Palmerola military base, where there were 5,000 U.S. troops based at that time. Today it's known as Soto Cano military base. It's in the middle of Honduras and in the Central Mountains. And apparently, Zelaya had been in talks with Washington about turning it into a civilian airbase, which would mean, you know, that the U.S. military wouldn't have access to it anymore. And they've, even though they don't have 5,000 troops there anymore, they haven't since the 1980s, but they still intermittently have troops there, not in the thousands, but in the hundreds. So he had been discussing this, and apparently the what he offered instead of the U.S. having access to Palmarola, now known as Soto Cano, they were going to be given access to the Caribbean zone of the country, particularly the Mosquito area along the Nicaraguan border, ostensibly to police it against narco traffickers, and there are a lot of narco traffickers who are using that coast without a doubt. But still, along the Nicaraguan border, gives us pause. Because, you know, this is all happening with the Sandinistas in power there once again, or at least they don't have a clear majority in Nicaraguan Congress, but they've got the presidency. Daniel Ortega, once again, the president of Nicaragua. So kind of this sense of deja vu, right? So and apparently, that was Zelaya's generals, particularly General Romeo Vasquez, who kind of went over his head and later led the coup d'etat, who had offered this to Washington as an alternative to Palmarola Air Base, but they would be, you know, granted access to La Mesquitia, to the mosquito rainforest in Honduras. So there's also this whole angle going on of, you know, military control of the region. And we can conjecture that perhaps, given that Romeo Vasquez went over Zelaya's head in making this offer to Washington, maybe Zelaya had balked on it. And that's when Romeo Vasquez decided to, have the coup d'etat and have him removed in connivance with the Congress and the judiciary, who are controlled by the most reactionary elements of the oligarchy, or so it would appear. So let's see, what else did I want to talk about? All right. I am going to have a piece of journalism on all of this appearing. I am told, I don't believe anything until it's true, in the next issue of In These Times, and should also be up on their website, possibly tomorrow, but sometime soon, I hope. And, here's where, even in my successful bids to try to, place journalism in the media, other than just, on my own website, even when I'm successful, there's sort of like this bitter taste in my mouth, because the piece which I wrote is basically, outlining everything which I just laid out to you over the course of the past hour. And it's a real black and white kind of piece. You know, Otto Reich is the bad guy. Emmanuel Zelaya is the good guy. And there isn't any nuance or complexity. Now, I wouldn't have written it if I didn't believe it. Certainly all the facts which I report in the piece are accurate. And certainly I do think that Otto Reich is a really bad guy. And I really do want to see Emmanuel Zelaya restored to power. It's only because... I hope the editors at In These Times aren't listening tonight. It's only because, I wrote an uncomplicated, black and white, sort of Manichaean, simplistic piece of journalism that it was accepted. And if I had written anything, as I know from bitter experience, which was trying to, grapple with complexities and contradictions, I would have been rejected with contempt, which is what usually happens when I try to play stories in the media outside of my own website. So, and this is where, this is why it's a good thing that I have a radio show, right? Because I can get to get my yayas out over the air for the moment in any event. So, this is where I've really got beef with Hugo Chavez. I'm just going to get this out of the way, and then we'll consider taking some phone calls at 212-209-2900. Because, Hugo Chavez, obviously, has been very, very, very strongly backing Zelaya and backing his return to power and backing the protesters in Honduras who have been demanding Zelaya's return to power and, backing the constitutional reform that Zelaya was trying to put through and backing the constitutional reform which Evo Morales put through in Bolivia. And great, I'm all for it. Terrific. But then he has to go and, immediately close ranks with Ahmadinejad in the contested election in Iran and completely sell out the protesters in Iran who are showing as much heroism as the protesters in Honduras, right? And are putting their lives on the line for freedom every bit as much as the protesters in Honduras. And it's just a fundamental betrayal. And that doesn't mean that I love Masui and Rafsanjani and the official leadership of the movement in Iran. You know, I've got plenty of skepticism of them, just like I've got skepticism of Zelaya. But it doesn't alter the fact that, you know, the people who are taking to the streets and opposing the undemocratic moves of the regime are, you know, they are in the right, every bit as much as the ones in Honduras are in the right. And, you know, particularly last week we were talking about the Uyghurs. And I'm not sure that the Uyghurs have come to the attention of Hugo Chavez, but certainly the Tibetans have. And he's been, you know, very, very quick to betray them as well and to portray, you know, the Dalai Lama as a CIA stooge and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I know from experience, unfortunately, that a lot of BAI listeners kind of go along with this charade that China is socialist. With which, by the way, on this point, they agree with the right in this country, which believes that, you know, China is communist. And that's why they oppose China, because they think that it's communist. So all you guys who support China because you think that it's communist, you agree with, you know, the hardcore nationalist right in this country, which opposes China because they think that it's communist. And you want to know what? You're both wrong. So I'm just going to read one news clip very briefly. Without any comment, or maybe just a little comment, from this is from the BBC, July 26th, one killed in China steel riot. Thousands of Chinese steel workers rioted at news of a takeover deal, beating one manager to death, a Hong Kong human rights group has said. About 100 people were hurt in violence in the northeastern city of Tonghua after workers heard that John Long Steel would buy a majority stake. They were reportedly frustrated at financial problems during John Long Steel's temporary control last year. John Long general manager Chen Gaojun was beaten to death, the group said. The Information Center for Human Rights and Democracy said 30,000 steelworkers clashed with riot police on Friday in the northeastern province of Jilin. The center reported that Mr. Chen was paid about 3 million yuan, or $440,000 last year, while Tonghua's retired workers received as little as 200 yuan a month. Okay. 3 million yuan, or $440,000 last year for Mr. Chen, as opposed to 200 yuan a month for the workers. The South China Morning Post quoted a police officer as saying the workers would not be allowed emergency medical staff to enter the building to help Mr. Chen. The Tonghua workers also reportedly blocked highways and smashed three police vehicles in Tonghua City, the center said. All right, so does this sound to you like socialism? Or does this sound to you like capitalism? I'm just asking, because to me, this sounds like capitalism, right? I mean, you know, the factory was, you know, being traded to some rival company, and the workers were being sold down the river. And, you know, meanwhile, the fat cat from the rival company was, you know, raking in 440K a year. I'm sorry, I'm not seeing the socialism here, so you guys are going to have to explain it to me. Now, while we wait for the calls to come in, I'm sure you all have plenty to say at 212-209-2900. Why don't we hear what the Garifuna do with Hang On Sloopy? Whoops, here we go.
Yeah.
right. That was Los Silver Star, another one of these great rock and Garifuna bands, with their version of Lupe, a Mexican standard, which is essentially the same song as Hang On Sloopy. And by the way, I should say that this genre of Garifuna rock is actually known as Punta rock. And a shout-out to my good friend Colby Luckenbill in Chicago, if you're listening tonight on the Internet, Colby, for bringing this great Punta rock back from Honduras for the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. All right, there's actually some people calling in at 212-209-2900. So we've got just 15 minutes for phone calls. Please be concise and get to the point, and we'll just keep on rocking along and see how many phone calls we can squeeze in. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
Were the Caribs cannibals?
I'm not sure how relevant that is to what we're talking about tonight. WBAI, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Hi.
I have been living in a country where the CIA invaded in 1953 and in 1962. Guyana, Georgetown, Guyana, and the footprint is there. We remember Grenada and this situation in Iran. It's all CIA.
Okay, I'm sorry. What's all CIA?
Well, the attitude, how they got the people roused up. It was the CIA who did that.
I'm sorry. Hang on. You're talking about Iran now?
The election that they had, and the opposition sort of came out and, you know, did what they had to do. But that was CIA.
What was CIA?
Instilled the people rising up.
I don't see how you can believe that. I mean,
I don't believe it. I've lived it.
Excuse me?
I've lived through that.
Well, hang on a minute.
Because in 1953, they came into Guyana, and they arrested the government. Chedi Jagan.
Yeah, I know the story.
And Bob Burnham.
Right.
And they had them locked up. And the CIA did that. You see, and in the 1962...
Right, but that wasn't the popular uprising. Okay?
It was not. 1962, when we had the 8-day strike, that was instilled by the CIA, too. I lived through that, sir. You didn't.
Well, when you've got the numbers who were taking to the streets as genuine courage in defiance of deadly repression, as we've been seeing in Iran, I don't see how you can claim that the whole thing. Hang on a minute. I don't see how you can claim that this is instrumented by the CIA. How are they going to get that many people? Unless people are legitimately angry at the government, how are they going to get that many people? It doesn't add up.
Cultures.
Excuse me.
Two different cultures. And the CIA sort of preyed on the people's weak points and brought them out. It's the CIA all around. Thank you.
Well, maybe the CIA is trying to manipulate the situation in Iran. In fact, we can be certain of that. But to say that, it's all the CIA or it's just the CIA, that doesn't quite add up. Anybody else want to call? 212-209-2900. WBAI, you're on the air. Please turn down your radio. Please turn down your radio.
Hey, Mel.
Yeah.
Hey.
Come on, turn down the radio.
I got it, man.
Well, how many times do I have to say it?
The cognitive dissonance is incredible. I'm catching on the delay. How are you, man? I see you smiling.
Oh, hi, Don.
I see you smiling. Please don't identify me.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, but
I didn't give a surname.
Not on air. Oh, God, what do I need? I'm not going to talk about the CIA for a change. I just want to urge folks to, listeners, supporters, contributors, and volunteers to support you. Even in your absence, should we get your co-host?
Well, it looks like that's going to be happening soon. I don't know, by the way, if I'm preempted next week. I'm yet to determine if I'm preempted next week.
Who could they put in there?
I've got an interview lined up, which I've been planning for weeks in advance, so I'm going to be really, really angry if I'm preempted.
Oh, lordy me. Who knows who runs it these days? Mm. What is going on up there? But a lot of that, I listen, with bated breath. I listen to your every word. And a lot of this goes past me because I just don't have this scholarship on the Central American issues.
Well, I hope I'm not being too dense.
No. You're being quite open, transparent, and enlightening. But sometimes I'm dense. We're dense out here in the morning, and we need the references. If you can point to the websites and get the antecedents.
www4report.com. Sorry to self-promote, but you know, there's so much information there. You know.
I know. I'm not jacked. Mm-hmm. Remember, you folks have
Oh, right, you're not Jack. Well, you just asked for websites.
I have to get myself together, you know. I have to get my head together, man. But, you know, I will this year. I realize I have to get with all the e-activists who are way ahead of me, you know. So you're having a good week. I can see you smiling up there.
Well, Don, I'm going to see if I can squeeze in a couple more phone calls.
Okay, buddy.
Okay?
Peace and love.
Thanks. And before I do, I'm just going to note here, just poking around on the internet, 1962 to 63, CIA fosters trouble in Guyana from historycommons.org. CIA promotes civil unrest in the Caribbean country of Guyana. Previously unheard of radio stations went on the air in the capital, Georgetown. The New York Times will later recount. The papers printed false stories about approaching Cuban warships. Civil servants walked out. The labor unions revolted. Riots took the lives of more than 100 people. Well, I don't know. WBAI, you're on the air. Please turn down your radio.
What happened to the discussion of BAI, Bill? How can you think the two sides are equal? Bernard,
is that what we're talking about tonight? I'm sorry. Is that what we're talking about tonight? That's not what we're talking about tonight. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Just a quick thing which pertains, I guess he meant it toward the Catholic Church or whatever, but it pertains to a lot of things that late, great Frank McCord said, and I'll add a word to it after I say his original statement. Belief is a substitute for thinking, and I add belief is a poor substitute for thinking. I think it pertains to a lot of things going on now. A cop-out, dogmatism, if you will. Okay, that's all.
Thank you. WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
Thank you for your good program. I see the discussion is about the ills of capitalism, and I wanted to invite people to Blue Stockings tomorrow evening at 7. I'll be reading from the book, from the works of Corliss Lamont, who wrote in 1939, You Might Like Socialism. And, of course, they didn't like it then. They don't like it now. And I'm reissuing his work with new update, 2009, What's Going On with the Stock Market at All. And my title is Lefties Are in Their Right Minds.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you.
WBAI, you're on the air. Please turn down your radio.
Good morning. Good morning this morning.
Yep.
Yes, hello?
Please turn down the radio, sir.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, speak up.
Yes, I just would like to say that the song you were playing earlier, the author or the artist is Mr. Flores. He goes by the name Mahabub Flores from Central America. He was born in Belize.
Oh, yeah?
Yes, the song...
which one? The Lupe song or the two before that?
Don't plant your land. Plant your land and reap your corn. Yeah.
Huh. I'm sorry. What's his name again?
Mahabub Flores.
And he's Belizean.
Yes, he's a Garifuna from Belize.
Huh. Maybe somebody else did the song because I've got it from El Tribu Garifuna, who are from Honduras.
Well, we're all one family: Honduras, Belize, Guatemala, and
right.
Nicaragua.
Yes. Yes.
Is there an email I could probably send you? There is a new Garifuna Cultural Center that opened. I can give you the address and the PR contact information.
Why don't you call my voicemail? That'd be good. Can you do that?
Sure. Let me get that.
Yeah. 212-631-1115. Yeah. Thank you.
No problem. Thank you so
much. Look forward to hearing from you.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. WBAI, you're on the air. You're on the air.
Have you given up plans to have the debate on your show?
I should have mentioned that. It isn't that I've given up plans. It's just that we can't come to consensus amongst ourselves as to who's going to represent and be on the air, unfortunately.
Right. Have you spoken to any of the people that you wanted?
Yes. We've been having email exchanges for the past 2 weeks, and it's not happening.
They don't want it.
That's,
I guess, right. Okay, thanks.
That's the short answer.
Yeah.
I should have mentioned that. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Yeah.
WBAI, you're on the air. You're on the air. Please turn down the radio and speak up.
Take a one-way trip to Cuba, you commie creep.
Thank you very much. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
You know you're a nigger-loving Jew, you nigger-lover.
That's lovely. Okay, now we're getting into the crank section, quite obviously.
Delusional knucklehead.
No, even more, obviously. You're on the air.
Yeah, with this Mr. Zelaya down there. I'm serious. He's making constant efforts to re-enter his country, right?
Well, I don't know about constant. He's made two so far.
Yeah, well, I mean, if he's not careful, I think you said he made two. I think if he's not careful, he's going to get two in the back of the head. That's what I think is going to happen, seriously.
Well, that may well happen. But
yeah, it will happen. I mean,
well, gee, thanks. Well, you have a crystal ball?
Where do I
get one? I want one, too.
No, but things happen.
Oh, things happen. Thank you for this penetrating insight. WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air.
I would like to request. I would like to hear Mr. Walk about the Mighty Sparrow.
Unfortunately, I don't have the Mighty Sparrow. Sorry. Maybe I'll play some Mighty Sparrow some other time. WBAI, you're on the air.
Do you enjoy being a moron?
WBAI. You know, maybe we should just go back to Garifuna music. I think that's the ticket, since we've obviously exhausted intelligent phone calls. Let's see, what else can we hear about what happened? This is reading from the New York Times of October 30th, 1994. A Kennedy CIA plot returns to haunt Clinton by Tim Weiner, all about the small clandestine operation in a little South American country 3 decades ago, when President Kennedy ordered the Central Intelligence Agency to subvert the country's leader. The leader fell, and the CIA's men quietly left town. Well, you know, I should be more up to speed on what happened in Guyana in 1962 than I am. But I question whether, movements of the obvious, degree of popular support that we've seen in Iran can be mere CIA-created astroturf. It kind of just doesn't add up to me. You know, if people didn't have legitimate reasons to be angry, they wouldn't be demonstrating such courage and taking to the streets. And it's rather an insult to the Iranian people to suggest that they are also, readily manipulated and are mere clay in the hands of the CIA, or mere putty in the hands of the CIA. Let's see. This is through the American Institute of Free Labor Development, of course, AFLD, a program run by the AFL-CIO, long aided anti-communist unions abroad. In the 1950s and 60s, a former U.S. intelligence officer say the CIA slipped money to the Institute. Yeah, we've heard that. The agitation grew throughout 1962 and 1963. A fire was set in the center of town. Dr. Jagan, the former leader, said the wind fanned the flames and the center of the city burned. There are still scars. Then they changed their tactics. This is where the CIA support came in full. They imposed a full blockade of shipping and airlines. We were helpless. We had no power. The British, at the suggestion of the Kennedy administration, delayed their colony's scheduled independence and changed its electoral system in October 1963. Now the electorate had to vote for parties instead of people, and a still popular but politically weakened Dr. Jagan fell from power. Once he fell, the British granted independence to the new Republic of Guyana. For the next 20 years, the country was governed by Forbes Burnham. As the British described him, an opportunist, racist, and demagogue intent only on power, a quote from A Thousand Days, which I believe would be Dr. Chetty Jagan's memoir. So, well, you know what? I'll tell you what. Out of deference to our listener, I will get up to speed on what happened in Guyana in 1962, and maybe we'll discuss it on these airwaves once again in the weeks to come and draw some parallels between that and what happened in Iran. But meanwhile, I still say solidarity with the protesters in Iran and solidarity simultaneously with the protesters in Honduras.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.